he could get great pressure in his legs, and he could lean away over and still hold that pressure and try to overbalance the chest below. And that was...
Was it a popular game?
At mess dinners, yes.
It seems we were wearing the very expensive mesh kit.
Oh yeah, oh sure, yeah. Yeah. I think I mentioned to you that Bredner had his mess kit split from crotch to ankle in one of those games.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, mess life was hard on uniforms.
Mm-hmm. In particular on the Air Force, do you think? Because in talking to others, it doesn't seem that they were quite as extroverted in the mess.
That may be. See, we were younger service, and the proportion of young men in the mess, I guess, was fairly high, and in the mid 30s.
Mm-hmm. And with youth, you get high spirits.
That's it.
Let me ask you something about the quarters. Just a few things we didn't pick on last time. About servants. Did you have some assigned to the quarters?
Yes. Air Force was very economical as far as servants are concerned, not unlike the Army.
Mm-hmm.
We regarded that as fairly wasteful of manpower. And you would have to have some servants in an officer's quarters building, for example. But generally speaking, there was one chap who was assigned to a floor, maybe even to a building, but certainly to a floor, depending on the size of the building, who would be the batman, and he would look after all the officers, mm-hmm. and he would be responsible for tidying up the rooms and so on, making the beds. Now, we talked about the 28-day hut at Camp Borden.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there might have been two batmen in that hut, like after the total number of officers. And don't ask me how many there were all together in it. I can't remember. But the junior officers would be two to a room.
It would all depend, I suppose, on how many men were staying in the quarters at the time to
That's
have any
right,
servants
sure.
somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course you had to have servants in the mess, but they would be service cooks and in some cases and general duties personnel to serve as waiters on tables or cleaners and so on,
mm-hmm.
and chefs, aides, and whatnot.
Would you have a civilian chef, or would you have a service?
I think on occasions they might have, but you tended more to have service personnel.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't be very precise on that in the early period. I just can't remember, but I think that they tended to be military. But it wasn't always possible to get a military cook, so I guess you would have some civilians. There weren't very many civilians employed at Borden or at Ottawa. I can't remember any in Ottawa at all in the mess there.
Now I wonder how they would be paid. Would they be on paid by the BND, Farm National Defense, or would people chip in and pay out of the mess fund or something?
No, they'd be paid by the Department of National Defense. They'd come out of the Air Force Board.
Yeah.
And of course, we would be on rations of the mess that would again be supplied by out of public funds. But if you augmented your messing, if you wanted some variety,
mm-hmm.
You would buy that out of the special allotment that was added to your bill for such purposes at the end of the month.
Mm-hmm.
And we in the Air Force, we augmented our ration quite a bit. We, we ate fairly well in the mess. And you could eat pretty well on the standard ration, but you didn't get much variety.
Mm-hmm. It was the same standard ration that was given to the other ranks.
That's right.
Well, let me ask you something else about the quarters. Was there things that you could own and you couldn't own? Any regulations concerning personal property? If you have a car and keep it on base?
I don't recall any restriction on a motor vehicle. Mm-hmm. if you're in an isolated area, it was rather almost necessary to have a motor vehicle. You would have restrictions on where you could park it.
Mm-hmm.
But there was nothing very... there was nothing that stands up in my mind there as being very difficult or awkward. As far as property is concerned, other than that, if you had a horse, I suppose, you had to make your own arrangements to house your horse. There weren't too many in the Air Force, but we did have a riding club at Camp Borden. That was one of the sports and pastimes. Flying officer Doug Edwards was the keen horseman there, and he organized a riding school and where the horses were kept, and I think they hired a civilian to look after the grooming.
Mm-hmm.
Property other than that, you were encouraged not to have too much property, but there was no regulation about it. The idea was that we were to be very mobile,
mm-hmm.
and it would be frowned upon if you had so much property that it took you any length of time to pack it up when you wanted to move from A to B.
So you wouldn't have a lot of books or records
no.
or things like that?
Well, you had books and records, and there was no regulation on how much of that you could have. It was just self-imposed. It became too cumbersome to have too much.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was stationed in Ottawa, and of course at this time I was not living in a mess. I was living in a civilian home, and when I would move about in and out of Ottawa, I had stored all of my
personal belongings,
possessions down in a room in the basement of that place. And unfortunately, I lost some of my stuff there. And you were always a little bit vulnerable. If you go away for several months at a time, you didn't know telling what there would be there. I had a very good stamp collection in those days. A lot of very early Canadian stamps, early Newfoundland stamps, early Nova Scotia, early New Brunswick, and PEI.
Those are
valuable stamps. That whole album, and plus all the stamps I had over and above those in the album, disappeared, and my books too.
Oh, they'd be worth a mint.
They really would.
Yeah,
it's sad when that happens. One didn't have very much in the way of possessions and ornaments in one's quarters. I think that things are fairly bare and utilitarian.
Let me ask you something else. Were you allowed to have alcohol in your room?
No, definitely not.
So there wouldn't be a bottle of scotch for medicinal purposes in your room at all?
No, not at all.
Why was it frowned upon?
Well,
lack of control.
It would, yes, I suppose as much as anything else. But you see, if there are any chaps in the mass or in the community who are tending towards alcoholism, it might be injurious to them if they had too easy an access to alcohol.
Or just exacerbate the problem,
yeah,
wouldn't
that's
it?
Right, yeah.
Let me ask you something else. And this is probably a silly question to begin with, but were there any regulations? And if not, were there any problems regarding women in quarters? Say someone tried to sneak someone in?
Well, yes, there certainly would be regulations about that. And I can't remember I can't remember an instance of anyone trying to infringe those regulations. I'm sure there must have been some occasions of that, but it was clearly known that that wasn't done, and that custom and practice was adhered to.
I suppose that if you wanted to, trying to phrase the mountain to Muhammad idea, that if you wanted the mountain, you'd have to go to Muhammad.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Let me see. When it was in a remote station such as Borden, the means of even when you had women coming in there on invitation to a ball, the means of housing them was a problem. You had to depend on the married families who were living there,
to take them in.
The married officers to take them in. And that, of course, meant that the girls were pretty well chaperoned while they were there. So,
being a military base, was there any problem with prostitution either outside the base or in Barrie, which was the closest town?
No. No. If there wasn't any problem at all, I don't think there would be any prostitutes in a place like Barrie or Allendale or any of those.
They're small like that. Communities, aren't they?
Yeah, it's too small, and you have to have a larger community to get that sort of thing. So Toronto would cater to the needs of anyone who had inclinations in that direction.
Okay, let's change the subject. And this is really the last thing I want to ask you.
Yeah.
And I don't know how major point it is, but the competition between the various branches of the service, was there any resentment or...
You mean branches within the Air Force?
No, the forces, the Navy or the Army.
Yeah.
Were they competitive? Were there any resentment? Well, in general, were the relations like?
Well, in my experience, and I think this was fair in general, relations were quite warm.
Mm-hmm.
The extent of the cooperation, the extent of the sharing of operational tasks and missions was somewhat limited in those days. You see, the Air Force really, we mentioned this before, was not really what you describe as a military force. In the 30s, in the 20s, and in the 30s. Its primary mission, as determined by the government, was to assist various government departments, federal and provincial, in matters such as survey and forest patrol and coastal patrol.
Customs.
Customs, running, and northern exploration activities, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So the aircraft that the Air Force had and the tasks that they were given, in the main, didn't facilitate cooperation with the other two services.
Mm-hmm.
once or twice a year, there would be on the east and the west coast, there would be exercises with the. With the Navy, and but
what
the aircraft would not be particularly suitable for the purpose.
No.
Well, there would be some anti-submarine patrol exercises, or there might be the odd reconnaissance mission, or there might be maybe the Navy would tow a target and we'd shoot at it and things like that, or we might. I don't think that we had the facility to tow a target for them to shoot at that stage.
Mm-hmm.
We would at a later stage. So the spirit was willing, but the facilities were limited.
Yeah.
And that didn't apply quite so much in the case of the army, because certainly by the 30s we had some aircraft which were suitable and to some extent designed for army cooperation.
Do you think in terms of air
artillery spotting and reconnaissance activities in general and strafing in front of the troops and things like that. And we had some training aides at places like Camp Borden, where you could ground training aides, where you could train the Army and the Air Force together in gun ranging and artillery spotting and so on.
Mm-hmm.
That was done on the ground, and also that would be air exercises. But again, the means to carry that out were not very great, and it didn't happen as much as one would like to have had it happen.
Yeah.
But that grew gradually through the 30s. But the relations were good and intimate. Now, for example, at Camp Borden, in order to facilitate that type of activity, certainly through the 30s, I'm not just sure when it started, but I think it started about the early 30s, maybe 31 or something like that, we had on our staff at Borden a major from the Army, who was a liaison officer with the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
to work up these exercises, and the relations were always extremely good. Now, one of those was that I remember particularly was Macklin, Slim Macklin. He was a well-known, eccentric army officer, a very likable chap, highly intelligent. And
would that ever been a basis for perhaps a bit of uneasiness between the services, in that in the Air Force it was technically oriented, and chances are you have perhaps a better educated group than you would have had in the Army?
Well, it wasn't evident at Borden because, for example, Macklin was a signaler.
Mm, they're fairly technical.
Signal Corps, he was very technical, and he was very intelligent. And his successor was Murchie.
Mm-hmm.
Murchie became Chief of the General Staff. Macklin became Major General, Charge Personnel. Murchie was artillery, I think, and artillery fellows were pretty intelligent and well-educated. And, of course, RMC, the Army tended to have RMC graduates, whereas the Air Force tended to have university graduates. And that was in some cases, that in itself might have made...
For elitism, at least, with the RMC types.
It made for a competitive spirit anyway. And whether it went beyond that, I don't know. We had, of course, both RMC and university, but the preponderance of Air Force officers in that period we have under review here were university grads.
Mm-hmm. Will this competitive spirit ever manifest itself in sporting events between the services?
Oh, yes, yeah.
The signalers take on the Air Force in a rugby match at Borden?
Yes, to some extent, but it generally didn't work that way. Generally, the Air Force was the bigger unit there,
mm-hmm.
and that made it a little bit... If you had two units of more or less the same size, you get good competition.
Mm-hmm.
What generally happened there was that the Signal Corps joined the Air Force, and jointly we fielded a Camp Borden team to play against teams from Hamilton, Toronto, and other places.
Mm-hmm.
Or I was thinking of rugby there, in hockey. You can get good hockey teams in Orillia and Midland and Barrie, and so we would go and play in those leagues, but it was generally a Camp Borden team They're called the Camp Borden Flyers, but you would have a, you might have a Finn Park on the, I don't think Finn actually played hockey, but we did have signalers on our hockey team, and some good ones too. Finn would have been good in the, General Clark would have been good in the, on the badminton team. That was his specialty. He was a good.
That's how great his wife was, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. You're right. Yeah, I think that's so. Well, locally, yes, teams such as softball teams, we'd have Air Force teams. You might have several Air Force teams. They would be unit teams. There might, and there would be a signal corps team. Yeah, you get a bit of inter competition there. But to answer your question, there wasn't too much. And that applied in all other locations in Canada. Generally, the Air Force was too small in the other locations to field a team against the Army or the Navy. Mm-hmm. I can remember speaking of, I guess I mentioned this to you before, during the time I was in the Queen Charlotte Islands, the Navy, a Navy destroyer came in to the Queen Charlotte's, our Canadian Navy. And the first thing that they want when they put into port is to have some athletic activity. And I was asked to form a, organize a baseball team. They're only going to be there for 24 hours. Form a baseball team, get a baseball game going, and then they would put 9 players ashore and bring a lot of the Navy personnel in as rooters and my total complement was 5. I had 5 Air Force people there, so we had to recruit a few of the local civilians, but that was quite a competitive game, I can assure you.
Who won?
I think that I would have to guess on that one. I guess I better not guess. I think we had a pretty good team on. We had the odd Indian on it, and the Indians were pretty good baseball players in that part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't do too badly. Yeah.
Well, to end up now, this one thing that I should have asked you about the uniform. Were you expected to buy a sidearm?
No. No. And the sidearms were not ordinarily carried in peacetime, at any time peacetime, and not ordinarily in wartime either. If you had to carry sidearms in war, it would be supplied.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for example, I never carried a sidearm when I was commander of a base in England during the war. I didn't have one even in my room, in my quarters. But when I went out to North Africa, I did. I went to my armored officer at Leeming, which was my base in England before I went out to. And I said to the armored officer, who happened to be a friend of mine, and I had had, I specialized in armament at one stage of my career, so I knew all the ins and outs and peculiarities of armored officers and the armament world.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I know that you've got a special pistol here that you prize for your own use in competition, and I'm not going to ask you to give me that one, but before I go to North Africa, I want the second best pistol on this base, and he was good enough to give me the number one pistol. You know, there was a difference in weapons like that, and
mm-hmm.
if you got a well-balanced weapon, you could be quite accurate in competition.
So
I went out there with Smith & Wesson 45, and it was pretty good pistol. And I had to drive every day to an ops conference from my base in North Africa, in Tunisia, up to the operational headquarters, because our communications were unreliable, and We couldn't assemble the operational data for the night's missions safely without going in person. So I had to motor about 35 or 40 miles in the heat of the noonday sun to attend an operational conference. I had my pistol on the seat beside me always on that drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in hopes I would find some Arab or some other intruder molesting our phone lines, because one reason I had to make this long, hot drive was because our lines were continuously cut.
Mm-hmm.
Every night somebody would go up there and cut the lines.
Yeah.
But that was the only time I really... Well, of course, there was always the possibility of being apprehended by some raiding mission. That was another reason I had a pistol there, because we moved in there very shortly after the Germans and the Italians were pushed aside, and of course they had a number of Arabs in their employ as well, and they left them with in them their employ to be awkward.
Mm-hmm.
And they make life difficult for the next people that arrived, ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So there was always the possibility that my car might be stopped. We weren't too far away from the one of my bases wasn't too far away from the hills. And then there were good hiding places up there. And from those, somebody could come out and plan a little raid, which might have stopped the car. That didn't happen, but it was a possibility.
Very real possibility.
Just cut that for a moment.
Well, actually, I think it's true if you like. Unless it's anything. Yeah.
That thing must be pretty well. Let me get a drink anyway, please.
Oh, there's just quite a bit, actually, but...
Yeah. Yeah, you were asking if there was anything else, huh? Well...
Anything you'd like to add that I perhaps haven't asked mm-hmm. or has come to mind?
Well, I'm not too sure whether we touched on this or not, but I'm sure we must have. There was a... We did talk about the difficult times and the depression years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a... It was almost a matter of struggling for survival, as far as the Air Force was concerned, when the appropriations were cut. They were very drastic in all three services, but the Air Force was just beyond belief. The Air Force vote was cut more than 75%
mm-hmm.
in 1932, and. Yeah, we did discuss the impact of that on the service, but it was so severe that it almost...
Well, it's restricted training. You couldn't buy any material.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yes, it really was...
Whereas the Army can train somewhat without a great deal of capital input.
Yeah, and we were exposed in the House to members of Parliament who were arguing that it was just a waste of money to maintain an Air Force. For example, the famous Agnes MacPhail, mm-hmm. I think she represented Kingston riding, or one of those ridings down in Kingston. She was forever on her feet trying to terminate the activities of the RCAF. But she was against military in general, but she...
Was she
liberal?
CCF?
Pick on the RCF. She was a... Agnes MacPhail. I guess she was a conservative.
She doesn't sound like any conservative I've heard of.
Oh, well, the conservatives are really...
A mixed bag with
it. Yeah. The Air Force had... this was before the days of the RCF, back in the days of the CAF.
Mm-hmm.
1920, 21, 22 and so on. When the Air Force was even more civilian in character
mm-hmm.
than it was in the early RCF days. We had great problems with some of the liberals at that time. Mackenzie King being he was a very reluctant supporter of the Air Force. He became, as time went on, and we got into the Second World War, he became a great This is a relative term when I say great, because he was never a great supporter of the military at any time, but he became much more enthusiastic about the heir, and he was willing to give the heir a great deal more backing, and I think solely because he felt there would be fewer casualties if the major thrust were in the air, as opposed to the army. Mm-hmm. Army meant one thing to him, vast numbers of casualties, and therefore great problems at in recruiting and replacement of those who were killed or those who were injured. And that, in turn, meant great political problems here at home. Mm-hmm. And it might even lead to conscription. And he had obviously had a feeling in World War II in the early stages that if the main Canadian effort were made in the air, that he'd avoid these problems of recruiting and conscription and so on. So I would suggest that perhaps one of the reasons for his becoming somewhat more enthusiastic about the air and less enthusiastic about the army was based solely on the political considerations and the fact it would be easier to keep this country together and keep the French Canadians in within the fold, mm-hmm. if he could avoid in some way great casualty lists.
Although, of course, we did have to eventually turn to conscription. But it wasn't really as a result of casualties as such. It was the fact that we had expanded to such a degree and we had such a large armed forces at the time that we needed the trained recruits. And because of our system when conscription did come, they were used on a limited basis, these zombie types. They weren't allowed to be used outside of Canada.
Yeah. Well, you could say that to some degree, but I think basically it was because of the size of the casualty list that conscription ultimately was a necessity. Yeah. There was this business of compulsory service, but not outside the country. That was a dodge, mm-hmm. political dodge, I suppose, in a way. And it served purpose to some degree of avoiding deep splits in the country. And for a time, I guess it avoided conscription. Mm-hmm. That's so. Then we had, of course, troubles. I've mentioned the Liberals were a little difficult in the early formative years. This would be the time when Arthur Meehan was in power as the Conservative member, and the Liberals were in opposition, I guess. And then when the Liberals got into power, they were not very helpful. But then, of course, when the Conservatives came into power in 1932, they were extremely unhelpful. But I guess one could argue that that was a condition of the times. But there was no... it doesn't justify the extent to which they slashed the RCAF. Mm. That was the time of R.B. Bennett and his cohorts. Mm. Mr. Grote Sterling was the Minister of Defense, I think, at the time. Admiral Sterling's father. Yeah, I think he was the minister then. So we had our ups and downs, that I must say, both during peace and war. But the Air Force didn't have a problem of maintaining its... The Air Force expansion was fantastic during the war. Mm-hmm. And we went from, as you know, a force of... just a little bit over 1,000 in the pre-war years, up to 225,000 during the war. But there was no difficulty supplying those squadrons with manpower or this training establishment with manpower. Mm-hmm. the country was an air-minded country, and the volunteers towards the Air Force were such that we had no problem meeting our quotas at any time. I suppose that was another thing that maybe Mackenzie King had in mind. He knew that there was a natural tendency towards the Air Force, and he wouldn't run into quite so many problems in the conscription issue or the recruiting issue, rather. If the weight were thrown in the Air Force direction.
Mm-hmm. The only thing is, the kind of people who would be conscripted would not necessarily be those who would go in the Air Force, in that those who'd be in the Air Force probably would have volunteered.
Yeah.
Being
that's right.
More socially responsible, or at least conscious of their responsibilities towards their country.
Mm-hmm.
And those that were conscripted would have gone into the armed forces as fodder, if you like, to fill up ranks.
Well, I can't think of anything additional. And I should be able to think of a lot more things, but...
I could ask you a lot more.
We're concentrating on a period that's a rather long time ago.
Well, I thank you very much. You've been very kind and most helpful, because I've been here 4 times.
Well, I hope we've rambled an awful lot. I hope you've got enough out of this to be of some value to you.
Oh, I have.
But tell me, again, now, what are you going to do with all this stuff?
Okay, well, I'm going to try very hard to do a paper. And it's been changing my mind as I've gone along, in that when we initially set out to do this, Dr. Roy suggested I do something on... Well, specifically on the social life of a permanent force officer between the wars. And I've come to the conclusion that you can't do anything quite that definite.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's going to be more like some aspects of the life of a permanent officer,
mm-hmm.
or at least an officer in permanent force. It's such a wide sweep. There's so much that can be covered by that term, social life.
Right.
I think some aspects. To keeping it out. I think the mess life would be the main consideration.
Yes.
Yeah. And perhaps also the differences between being a bachelor and being a married officer. Because that's...
Yeah.
And the effect that women have, at least in terms of being married to them, and how it changes one's relation to the forces.
Well, that's an important aspect. Yeah, I remember you asked me questions about that. About the wife, is a very important member of the team. No question about that.
Mm-hmm.
And if the mate chosen was not the best or the most suitable, it could certainly and did affect the career, and it affected the value of the team. You know. An officer and his wife, as they progressed through the service, operated as a team and social unit and as a force in the Air Force community and in the civil community. And you had two strong and helpful and cooperative members working together in that team. It made all the difference. And I think, by and large, the choices were carefully done and effectively done. Is that the end now?
We're very close.
Yeah.
Perhaps I should shut her off. Thanks very much.
Yeah,
sir.
Good.